From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When the pandemic hit London, director Simon Godwin's National Theatre production of Romeo and Juliet shut down before it could open. So Godwin shot the play as a movie, never mind that he had never even picked up a camera and couldn't film outside the theatre.
So there would be no locations, there would be no trips to Italy, there would be no even natural light. And yet, I remembered a phrase from the Stoics who had the motto, the obstacle is the way.
Even without a trip to Fair Verona, Godwin shot his movie, starring Josh O'Connor and Jesse Buckley, in a mere 17 days. Godwin's version of Romeo and Juliet is now streaming on PBS. He tells us why he thinks the Bard would love the movies and approve of taking some creative liberties, including giving Lord Capulet's lines to Lady Capulet. But first we banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we now have been told, as expected, that HBO Max and Warner Media, they're going to roll out a $10 a month ad-supported subscription, and you can see HBO Max programming for this $10 a month with ads, and you get HBO programming not interrupted by ads. So basically, at least to start out, for $10 a month, you get Max with ads, and then the purity of HBO, as we don't have commercials, is maintained. And for 10 bucks a month, you know, maybe people will think that's a good deal.
I think they will, because, you know, currently HBO Max is the most expensive streaming service at $15 a month. You're essentially saying to people, subscribe to HBO Max with ads, and you're going to still get all the premium HBO content, plus you're going to get this other stuff with ads for $5 cheaper. It's a pretty compelling argument to do that. And it's a way for Warner Media to get around the problem that they have had from the beginning with HBO Max, in that HBO is an expensive service. And that's what's limited it to growing subscribers in the past, is that they charge a lot. And now they're going to be able to charge less with this ad tier while keeping that premium HBO content intact.
Yeah, the overarching theme of all of this right now is streaming wars getting very real, right? They're realer and realer. I mean, this is what Endeavor, which just went public, is selling partly, you know, that they are telling investors, hey, we have the UFC, which is one thing, but all this streaming demand, all of these players throwing money at programming, we're going to make money on that too. That's part of the argument. And that's all great and good, except if you're the ones who are on the hook spending the money. And then you start wondering whether people are going to die. And I don't know. We just saw Peacock turn in some numbers. I wouldn't say anybody was throwing a parade for those. Like, how do you differentiate yourself? I don't know. It's very tough to keep eyeballs glued to your service.
Yeah, the Peacock numbers are interesting for NBC Universal because they're touting this 42 million signups number. And remember, Peacock is mostly ad supported. So it's basically just 42 million people have downloaded the app and indicated that they might be interested in watching something on Peacock. That's very different from a subscriber who has agreed to give his or her money to you every month. And that's where HBO Max and Netflix and Hulu and Disney Plus, they're playing in that sandbox. And that's very difficult. And if you're someone like Netflix, where you already have market penetration to a point where your numbers are starting to slow down, they've got to not only figure out how to get new subscribers, but they've really got to focus on how to keep the subscribers they have and prevent them from churning and going elsewhere or going to no place.
Yeah, this is where Joe Adalian of Vulture had an interesting thing this past week about the play something option on Netflix. And really, in a way, this is like a throwback. It's like channel surfing, right? You see this little thing when you get into your Netflix queue and it says play something, because this is a way to try to deal with this kind of fatigue of having too many choices, where you may throw up your hands and say, ugh, I can't slog through all of this. I can't figure out what I want to watch. And you just go somewhere else and do something else. And I think that's real. I mean, there are a couple of forces at work. There's a multiplicity of offerings, which certainly gives me some fatigue and gives a lot of people pocketbook fatigue. And then within each service, there's this incredible multiplicity of choice, which may be great unless you're trying to break through and lock people in. That's a hit-driven proposition, and that's not easy either to sustain the flow of hits that people really want to watch.
Yeah, decision fatigue is real. We've all dealt with it. Joe hit it on the head here when he quoted some people at Netflix saying the real value for Netflix is convincing you that there is still more stuff that you've got to see, because that's what keeps you subscribed. And that's their ultimate goal. So it's not just about having hits. It's about making sure that you, the viewer, is matched up with something that is going to appeal to you as much as possible. So having this kind of lean back experience rather than a lean in experience where you have to search and hunt for it is pretty smart, because that's what we like in many instances, is to sit back, relax, and put something on. And if the algorithm is going to help juice that choice, where maybe you've watched five reality shows and they're going to suggest a sixth that might be good and something you haven't heard of, if that's the best way to reach someone and get them to spend more time on your service, that's a win for Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, between the two of us, there's sort of like a mini non-scientific study proving nothing, but you have clicked on this and I have been reluctant to click on it, partly because there's some innate part of me that says, they don't really know what I like. And partly because my kid, for whatever reason, chooses to come in as me sometimes and is watching stuff I would never in a million years watch. But I have this feeling it's really screwed up their algorithm, and the rebellious part of me is thinking, yeah, I'm going to screw up the algorithm. Even though it doesn't help me at all.
Well, you need to set up different profiles for different people in your household. It's a game changer.
Yes, but I know that.
but I have tested it out. It's fine. It's nice. But you know, think about it. The whole of broadcast television is based on this notion that you would tune in to CBS at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, and there would be something there that would appeal to a mass audience. And Netflix is trying to replicate that a little bit, while also using data and algorithms to supercharge that search for something that you might like.
Yeah, I mean, for me already, though, I am in a state now of searching. Like when I hear about something, I don't know where it is. I already don't know where it is. Like there's no brand loyalty for me, because I don't, you know, I'm not thinking I'm going to go to Hulu and watch something. I'm like, I heard about this. Where is it? And I literally have to search for it.
Yeah, that's a problem. And, you know, the bigger problem here for these services is they've got to prevent churn. And yes, content prevents churn, but also the user interface prevents churn. And Joe did a nice job in this piece getting into the fact that Netflix has really excelled in their user interface and getting that thing to where, first of all, it comes on right when you click on it, and it goes right to the best way to find out what might interest you. And it has new releases and what's trending and all of these different ways to find content. I mean, if you look at some of these other services, I hate to pick on Viacom CBS, but Paramount Plus is just awful. The searching is terrible. The movies are alphabetically listed. Like, who searches that way? And put that on top of the fact that they don't have the best content library. And then you flip over to Netflix and the user interface is just so much easier to use. And that, if that makes a small difference in the user experience, that leads to a big difference in who churns. And we're seeing those numbers. Netflix has been very good about preventing churn. And obviously they have a huge advantage in being a first mover, and many people consider it to be like a utility. But the other services have really had more problems with churn than Netflix has, and they want to keep it that way.
Yes, I think that is a fair statement. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
Those opening lines in director Simon Godwin's version of Romeo and Juliet are delivered by Lucian Mizamati, not to a packed house, but rather to a group of actors on a bare stage looking like they're about to start rehearsal. For this production of Shakespeare's tale of star-crossed lovers, Godwin moved the action to modern times, and he shot, by necessity, completely inside the Littleton Theatre in London. That's where he'd planned to mount the play before the pandemic forced a change of course. Switching instead to a stripped-down film version, there isn't much in the way of scenery, but the doomed pair, played by Josh O'Connor and Jesse Buckley, still make sweet love at Juliet's makeshift balcony.
What man art thou?
By a name, I know not how to tell thee who I am.
Art thou not Romeo and a Montague?
Neither, fair maid, if either thee dislike.
How camest thou hither, tell me, and wherefore? This place is death, considering who thou art. If any of my kinsmen find thee here...
With love's light wings did I o'erperch these walls, for stony limits cannot hold love out. And what love can do that dares love attempt, therefore thy kinsmen are no stop to me.
Godwin moved from the UK to Virginia in the fall of 2019 to lead the Shakespeare Theatre Company in Washington, D.C., but he was still supposed to direct a play a year for the National Theatre in London.
And the show that I was going to go back and do that summer was indeed Romeo and Juliet.
So just, tell me the story of what happened with that. Where are you and when does the bad thing start with the pandemic?
Well, we're in Washington in our larger theatre, the first season of mine that I programmed. And in the larger theatre, we were playing James Baldwin's The Amen Corner. And in the smaller theatre, we were playing The Time of Athens in a production that I had directed. Both of them ceased. And then I was unsure whether I was still going to go back to London to direct Romeo and Juliet. And then eventually that was cancelled as well. And we were faced with this quandary. Could we salvage something from the Romeo and Juliet? And that was when Rufus Norris, the director of the National Theatre in London, and David Sable, who'd been brought in as the producer, and I thought, well, maybe we could try and do somehow a film of this play.
Had you thought of doing a film thing, a digital streaming something before the pandemic?
No, I hadn't. I think with the pandemic, suddenly all theaters in the world were thinking, what kind of digital offering can we create? How can digital be a way out of this kind of emergency? And so this idea came up slowly grew that maybe we should try something digital. But if we did something digital, how could we make it really cinematic, as well as looking after and sort of acknowledging the theatrical roots of this experiment?
So you are in Washington at this point, like on Zoom or some Skype with folks in London saying, can this be done?
Completely. In fact, I was in a village hall in Erectortown, which is a very small village in Virginia, where I would drive to because that was where I could find really good internet. Yeah, it was lo-fi. So I would be on calls with Rufus and also actually with Josh O'Connor and Jesse Buckley, the two actors that I cast to play Romeo and Juliet, who I went to and said, what do you think? You've done a lot of films before. Could we make something cinematic? And so there were a lot of long calls between Jesse and Josh and I trying to think of ways we could make it work.
They had done film before, but you had not.
That is correct. I had not. And that was, it was amazing in retrospect. The National Theatre were quite as, and PBS, our partners in America, were so willing to take a risk on me because not only had I not directed a film, I hadn't even directed a short film. I hadn't even really picked up a camera. I didn't even quite know what a camera was. So I couldn't have been less well qualified to take this challenge on.
Yes. Well, so at what point does the National Theatre Company say, well, you know, we're interested, but we need an American partner, or, you know, because there's a question of who's paying for this as well, right?
That's right. The National Theatre had various conversations with different potential partners, and Sky came forward in the UK to be our UK partner. And then brilliantly, PBS came forward to be the American partner. And we also worked with another American production company. And between us all, the funds got raised and it was done modestly, but it was brilliant that America and the UK could combine so brilliantly. And actually, it was super that I was already directing a Shakespeare Theatre Company in America. So if there's sort of suddenly those marriages seem to make a lot of sense.
Did you have to sort of go out and explain how you, a person with no film experience, were going to do this, but it was going to be okay?
Yes, there was quite a lot of pitching involved, although I think the partners were very reassured that Josh O'Connor and Jesse Buckley were already cast because they were such recognizable names and artists in their own right. And Rufus Norris, the director of the National Theatre, had made some films. And I think he very much presented himself as a sort of mentor for me, as indeed he proved to be.
I'm wondering, to what extent did he mentor? I mean, how did you make avail yourself of him as a resource?
Well, I think he was very helpful in advising me about the right team to bring around me to make the film. I was fortunate that we found a terrific director of photography who was a very kind, nurturing person who every morning in rehearsals would come in early and basically put me through film school. And I will always be very indebted to him. And then Rufus was very good at just visiting me on the set and having a look through the monitor and saying, hey, I think you've got another take there. Or, hey, how about trying it slightly differently? And he was just a kind of very generous big brother to have by my shoulder. And I'm very grateful to him for that.
Yes, I think so. I mean, with this on-the-job training, what would you say is the big that one or two lessons that came through from this, you know, that the thing I know just from my very limited experience dealing with cameras myself is everything theatrical is bigger and projected outward in a bigger way. And with the camera, the smallest movement can start to feel too theatrical.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. When I first started, because we had 4 weeks of rehearsal before we had the 17 days of filming, and those 4 weeks were very important because they were a chance for me to grapple with the question that you're identifying, the question of scale. And initially, I was very confused by why the actors were speaking so quietly all the time. And then they explained to me that, of course, they would have microphones and this wouldn't, yes, it wasn't necessary to project.
We can hear you. Yes.
Exactly. So I realized how much of my job as a theatre director is essentially spent going louder. They need to hear you at the back of the Olivier stalls, please. And this was totally unnecessary. And equally realizing as well that when I block theatre productions for a large stage, you have to put in a huge amount of movement so that the audience can see the faces of the actors. And again, this was very different because in cinema, you actually want to limit movement. Freneticism doesn't really work, and also it requires a lot more shots. So I needed to find a way of acting and of behaving, which was more focused, more distilled, and ultimately more available to the eye of the camera and the mind of the audience. And that was the exciting thing to discover, that really this was a way of entering Romeo and Juliet's minds in an unprecedented way, to really gain access to Romeo and Juliet in a way that probably most people have never had before. I certainly hadn't had before.
I mean, did something about their characters reveal itself to you that in all the Shakespeare you've dealt with in the past, you thought, I never saw it that way before?
Yes. I think that, for example, when Jesse came to film the monologues of Juliet, the sense that you could be in a room with Juliet close up and that she needed to make no concessions whatsoever to a public audience, that we really could live like ghosts next to her, eavesdropping on the inner workings of Juliet's mind, was a very unique experience for me.
I almost hate to ask this question, but did you go back? Obviously, there's the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet that a lot of people wept over, I think, years ago, and is present. Even my younger daughter is aware of, has seen that. And I wonder whether you went back and took a look at it or thought, I'm not going to look at that.
Actually, I had seen it myself a few years ago, and as I had also the extraordinary film directed by Baz Luhrmann, too. So in Zeffirelli and Luhrmann, you have two remarkable accounts of that play. And what helped me when I was watching them, and I think I do learn from tradition and learn from past experiments and productions. But for us, what was in some sense helpful poignantly was that we knew our conditions, our world, our context was profoundly different from theirs, and that the pandemic in itself forced us to create a version of the play that was extremely idiosyncratic and in a way liberated us from any attempt to try and copy or be in the shadow of those remarkable past productions.
I assume you had maybe a moment of jealousy. I'm sort of, my mind goes to the galloping messenger, I think. I mean, I haven't seen the Zeffirelli movie in years, but I sort of remember this thing that explains why nobody could forewarn Romeo of what was going on with Juliet. And for you, that was and for any stage person, but especially during a pandemic, I think that Was that something where you were like, I wish I could have that galloping horse?
Well, quiet gallop apace and all that. It was striking to be asked to direct a film of Romeo and Juliet in 17 days, never leaving the Littleton stage. So there would be no locations. There would be no trips to Italy. There would be no even natural light. And yet I remembered a phrase from the Stoics who had the motto, the obstacle is the way. And how could we make it completely meaningful and actually powerful that we were trapped in a shuttered theatre? And as we worked together in these conditions, we discovered that, okay, we couldn't have the locations, we couldn't have the sunlight, the Italian landscapes, the galloping horses. But what we could do was to have a very deep connection between this group of actors who had gathered in this closed theatre to try and tell the story. And in that, the feeling of touch became very charged, probably because we were living in a world where to touch somebody would be to risk your life. We were living in an unvaccinated world in which we were gathering together and being regularly tested and doing everything we could to be safe, yet never being entirely sure that we were. So in a play in which touch is lethal, it was remarkable to be doing that play in a time when touch was comparably dangerous. And I think when I watch the film now, I think it contains that intensity that we would never have got in any other context.
I read that the two leads had to be tested. There were intimate scenes, obviously, in Romeo and Juliet. So they had to be tested, and then they could pull the masks off, and you had like a 3-hour window to, I don't know how many of those you had, but you were to get those scenes shot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it meant, so we were rehearsing these scenes in masks and socially distanced. And then, yes, it was sort of right. This is the moment when you're most likely to be safe. So mask off. Dive in. And it was like sort of quenching a thirst. And it was very powerful. And of course, in this story of all-consuming obsessive love, it did poignantly and perversely, in a way, help us deliver those scenes with power.
Josh O'Connor has, I think you must have cast him before The Crown was on Netflix.
That's right. Josh came in to audition for the part of Romeo. The first series was about to come out. So he'd filmed it, but no one had seen it. I actually had met Josh several years beforehand when he'd been at drama school in Bristol, where I had been working at the local theatre. So I'd met Josh, and it was amazing to re-encounter him after a few years in this audition and realized what an extraordinary actor he was. And I had an inkling that he was going to be rather amazing in The Crown. So I was very keen to book him as Romeo.
Yes, it's almost, I don't know if you worried that people would be seeing Prince Charles while they were watching Romeo, but he certainly inhabits a role, I will say that.
Yes, absolutely. And in a way, but I think the fact that he inhabited Prince Charles so brilliantly made me certain that he would also inhabit Romeo so brilliantly. I think what's wonderful about Josh is that he is, like Jesse, versatile and able to inhabit a different body and have something that's intrinsically uniquely him, but also in contact with the unique resonances and aspects of the character that he's playing.
I mean, maybe it was a stroke of luck and helped with the financing that did that role roll out into the world as you were trying to help get your funding or
no? Yeah, I think that's absolutely. I think that cinema is a commercial project. And I think when you have actors that are well known, it really helps. And fortunately, they're also, in this case, brilliant. So we had the best of both worlds.
Coming up after a short break, Romeo and Juliet director Simon Godwin tells us how he slashed the Bard's 3-hour play down to 90 minutes. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Simon Godwin about his film version of Romeo and Juliet, which is streaming on PBS through May 21st. Godwin's version of Romeo and Juliet was cut down to a TV movie-friendly length of 90 minutes. That means some familiar lines and scenes hit the cutting room floor, starting at the beginning of the show when the feuding houses of Capulet and Montague rumble, but there's no belligerent talk of biting thumbs.
If you were to read the original, the entire play, it would be over 3 hours. And yet the prologue, says Shakespeare himself writes, refers to the 2 hours traffic of our stage. So clearly Shakespeare was writing more than he needed. And I think he always expected and assumed that the plays would be adapted and cut down to the durations that were going to be required, even in his own day. So for me to then do his plays justice, well, I knew that the cinema was a form in which language was less central than the theatre, because cinema is so much about image and different kind of storytelling. And I wanted it to be a film which people could watch who didn't know the play, who were entirely, in fact, new to Shakespeare, and were watching it potentially on their computers or even their telephones. So how could this be a version which was an amazing, as it were, gateway to the play and to Shakespeare's writing? So for me, in a way, it was not straightforward, but it was certainly clear that we had to make it super pacey. And when the broadcasters came back and said around 90 minutes was their paradigm, I leapt into that and said, fine. And that the best way I think of serving Shakespeare is not to be reverential or scholastic, but to be really audacious, because I think that's how he wrote.
And you changed, you know, certain roles, and you, I think I read somebody said you feminized, is that the word of the play?
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it? Feminized, I saw that too. I think, well, what we certainly have done is to take the role of, you'll remember that in the original, Lord Capulet, Juliet's father, is the man who stands in the way of his daughter's happiness by demanding violently that she marries Paris. Now, in this version, we've given those lines to his wife, Lady Capulet, and given Lady Capulet's lines to Lord Capulet.
How now? A conduit, girl? What? Still in tears, evermore showering. How now, my lord? Have you delivered to her my decree?
Aye, ma'am, but she will none. She gives you thanks.
Are you not proud? Do you not count yourself blessed, unworthy as you are, that I have wrought so worthy a gentleman to be your bride?
So we've rebalanced it and said this: in this family, it's not the man that's the figure of authority and ultimately of threat, but the woman. And I think that gives Juliet's relationship with her mother an extraordinary new dimension. And I think it's one of the many decisions that we tried to make, which have, as it were, interrogated the gender politics that have been attached to the play for so long, and hopefully combined to help us experience the play in a newly resonant and impactful light.
You're playing around with Shakespeare as you think Shakespeare would have wanted.
Exactly. That's right. Because what's fascinating is the more, of course, scholarship we do around Shakespeare, the more we discover that he wrote plays with other people. He was very collaborative. He wrote different drafts. He adjusted things through performances. I think he was a very, very pragmatic writer, much like the screenwriters of today. In fact, there's a lovely quote from the filmmaker Derek Jarman saying he thought Shakespeare would have loved the cinema. And I'm sure he's right.
Simon Godwin is the artistic director of the Shakespeare Theatre Company in Washington, D.C., and the director of Romeo and Juliet for London's National Theatre. That performance is now streaming on PBS through May 21st. Thank you so much for talking to us about this interesting experiment.
It's been a real pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor and Kat Yore. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. A love-struck